So what were the big stories of this baseball and fantasy baseball season? Who were the biggest hits and the biggest busts? I'll ask Todd Zola and Ray Murphy those questions and a whole lot more next on Baseball HQ Radio.
Learn to play the winner's way, because Baseball HQ Radio starts right now. And here's your host from BaseballHQ.com, columnist Patrick Davitt.
And welcome to Baseball HQ Radio for Tuesday, October the 3rd. It's show number 34 of the 2023 fantasy baseball season. I'm Patrick Davitt, your host, and I'm pleased to present another Tuesday Roundtable edition for you. It's our end-of-season roundtable with Todd Zola from Masters Ball, ESPN, Sirius XM, and RotoWire, and Ray Murphy from BaseballHQ.com. We'll start the show with the big stories from the year just ended in real baseball and in fantasy baseball, and we'll talk about the lessons we might have learned that we can use as we start prepping for 2024. Then in part two, we'll talk about the players, the fantasy busts for 2023, the fantasy rookie of the year, the fantasy Cy Young, and the fantasy most valuable hitter for 2023, and we'll have our boons and banes among hitters and pitchers for 2024. It's our Tuesday end-of-season roundtable edition. Thanks for joining us here at Baseball HQ Radio. Hey, what do you say? The season's wrapped up, so we're going to talk some baseball. And in the first inning of this Tuesday end-of-season roundtable edition, part one of our discussion, the big stories of the year. And let's start by welcoming our guests. To my left and your right, assuming you have your headphones on right way around, Todd Zola from Masters Ball, ESPN, Sirius XM, and RotoWire. Todd, welcome to the roundtable.
Great to be back with you guys. I mean, it's not, and that means it's postseason, but it's great to be back with you guys.
And over there in your left ear, Ray Murphy, the co-general manager, projections meister, analyst and writer at BaseballHQ.com, and of course, our regular news analyst here at Baseball HQ Radio. Ray, welcome to the show.
Yeah, glad to be here. I agree with Todd, not my favorite day of the year by any means, but this makes it a little bit better.
One last chance to talk about it. I know all over Twitter and a lot of the tout sites and so forth, everybody's talking about the year and talking about what went on. So we'll take our turn and we'll do it in the usual pattern. In the first part, we'll talk about the news and stuff. Then we'll talk about player performance this year, and then we'll look ahead to player performance for next year. But let's start with the news and stuff I wrote down for 2023. And we'll start with the big story of the fantasy baseball season. Ray Murphy, why don't you kick us off?
I think I'm glad I get to go first here, because I think the discussion here kind of has to start with Ronald Acuña and his historic season. We'll get into the details and the just utter magnificence of it throughout the offseason, I'm sure. But just an amazing $60-plus season, depending on what your actual your preferred valuation spreadsheet burps out. 41 home runs, 73 stolen bases, a .337 batting average. Just a stunning display. And I was just looking at the splits underneath that. He had .343 with 11 home runs and 11 stolen bases in September. It was just, everything about this is just bonkers. And the more I look at his page on our website and in our player link database, the more just staggered I am. I might need most of the offseason just to fully appreciate what Ronald Acuña did this year.
I could certainly have used that September on my Tout Wars AL team. Unfortunately, that's the wrong league. Todd, what's your big fantasy baseball story for the year?
Yeah, just quickly to piggyback, not so much piggyback, but I was thinking of the Acuña season. My thing didn't burp. It puked out in the 70s. What if Acuña were in the same league as Ohtani? Who's the MVP? That would be fun. But we don't get to talk about that. All right, my big story... it's to me, and the numbers showed it going in, but coming out, they showed it as well. It's kind of the leveling off of the pitcher, the numbers earned for pitchers, that there really isn't the highs and the lows. They're really scrunched. And if that's the case, it should affect drafting strategies. Now, the NFBC is its own world. Nothing affects the NFBC. But in the real world, if there's not that much difference between the tiers at the top, you know, supply and demand. The supply is pretty heavy. You shouldn't be paying for pitching. So I think in normal non-NFBC leagues, I think we may see less of a movement to pay for pitching next year.
I'm glad to hear your numbers show that too, Todd, because I definitely see that in my numbers, and I had questions about what was driving it, but it is a fascinating trend.
It's the lower innings. It's just the pitching itself, I think. And you also probably noticed American, you know, it used to be in a mixed league draft, I don't want to touch an American League pitcher except maybe a closer. It flipped the script. It's American League pitchers over National League pitchers this year.
Definitely noticed.
And that. My big fantasy story kind of dovetails in with that fantasy story. And my story was starting pitchers disappointing their fantasy managers, especially starting pitchers that were taken in the highest rounds. There were 7 starters taken in the top 3 rounds by the NFBC's ADPs, and I think the names are pretty familiar across most leagues, but only 2 of the 7 finished in the top 3 rounds by fantasy value. Gerrit Cole and Spencer Strider, and Luis Castillo was pretty close to a 3rd round guy, but actually was slightly into the 4th by Baseball HQ's dollar values. I know there's been some rethinking about the wisdom of taking starting pitchers early. It was, 2, 3, 4 years ago when people started saying, I'm going to take pitchers, pocket aces. This seemed to be the big breakout strategy, and for a while it seemed to work. But this last year, I don't know that it did work because there was a lot of really good value, to Todd's point, later on in the draft, in the 5th, 6th rounds. You could get pitchers like George Kirby and pitchers of that ilk, maybe a little earlier than that, but certainly you didn't have to spend a top 1 or 2 pick to get your ace level pitcher. I'm not saying don't draft Gerrit Cole or Spencer Strider in the 1st round this coming year, but I think I might be tempted to let somebody else take them so that I could load up on hitters in those 1st 3 rounds like we used to.
I think we're going to have to see what the NFBC top teams did. It's a monkey see. I know we're getting NFP centric. It's a monkey see, monkey do thing. And I could check this. I haven't checked it, but I'm not in the main event. But if the top teams waited on pitching, we're going to see people wait on pitching. The reason that pitching went high is because at the time that people did it, it was the zag to the zig, and it worked. But now I don't know that it's going to work anymore. But it takes the NFPC is going to take a lot to convince them not to take pitching early.
Yeah, it seems to bounce back and forth, that's for sure. Let's move on to the big story in real baseball. Todd, why don't you kick us off here? What story affected the real game?
I'm going to go with the shortening of the time of games. I could talk forever about the propaganda about how they're saying the game's better than it's ever been, and it's basically back to the way it was 2 years ago. But like there was never a diving play before the shift, which was only used 33% of the time. But yet we're acting like it was used every play. But point being, the games are shorter. There's no doubt. You can measure it. Attendance is up, but I'm not sure if that's completely because of the shorter games. People are more comfortable going on in public now. So I think that has to do with it, 9% increase of attendance. But I think TV ratings are up. And that, I think you can definitely say, has to do with the more – shorter game, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So I think the shorter games have affected the pitch clock has affected the games now. I heard one announcing crew wonder if, wow, these players are taking so many timeouts, it's lengthening the game. If they limit the timeouts, I may have to start like following hockey.
I was thinking about the attendance too, and I wondered if we did see, for instance, Baltimore had a gigantic increase, and I think part of it is you put a winning team on the field, you're going to do better at the gate, unless you're a team like the Yankees or Boston or somebody where you tend to do pretty well at the gate every year, and in Tampa where no matter what kind of year they're having, they never seem to do well at the gate. But Cincinnati had a pretty exciting team. Their attendance was up. You have all of these kind of second-tier attendance teams because they were second-tier achievement teams. And all of a sudden they started winning games and they started drawing fans. And I don't think that's incidental one to the other. My story for the year, you guys, was injuries. I did a quick review and I found these data points. The number of IL stints was actually down this year, possibly because of steps that were taken by the leagues to limit IL-related shenanigans that the Dodgers made famous, but the number of players being lost for the season went up a lot. In 2022, about a quarter of all players who went on the IL were lost for the year. This year, that number was 32%. Yeah, 19% of hitters jumped to 23%, and 30% of pitchers from 2022 who went on the IL were lost for the season. This year, that was all the way up to 38%. So the pitchers were dropping like flies. I imagine from our own experiences with our leagues, we probably suspected something like that was going on. The one shining ray of good news in all of this, Tommy John surgeries were down from 25% of pitcher ILs last year to only 15% this year. And I don't know if that's a trend, but I certainly hope it is. Ray, what do you think?
Yeah, I just pulled some injury data last week for preparing for the forecaster, and the total number of DL days this year was still over 40,000, which, I mean, it's just a staggering number. Let's not sugarcoat it. I'm glad the trend is, you know, getting better. Maybe we're a little past peak. Maybe that's just got to do with not having COVID ILs, but, you know, injuries are still a huge part of the game. Of course, my big story of the year in baseball, and I hate to use these words, so I'm going to use them very carefully and hope I don't choke on them, but Rob Manfred got it right. Like, it pains me to say that, but you know, we talked a lot in all of our conversations last year about the rules, everything from our round tables to First Pitch Arizona, about all of the potential unintended consequences of changing all of these rules at the same time and the interoperability of them, and that nobody could ever foresee what the consequences were. And maybe we were being a little hysterical about that, but by and large, I mean, we can quibble over whether Rob Manfred's objectives were the objectives he should have, but Rob Manfred got what Rob Manfred wanted out of the rule changes. And for a guy who, you know, most of the time can't get out of his way, that's as surprising as it is good, I guess.
Can we put an asterisk and say, we don't know if the pitch clock is the reason for all those pitcher injuries? The possibility exists. And if it is, to me, that balances, I'll take a longer game if I have better pitching out there, you know, I mean, so. But the problem is, as you kind of alluded to, there were so many things going on. I can't say unequivocally that the extra injuries are because of the pitch clock. I can't. There were too many other things going on. So that's my only caveat is we're just not sure. And looking at the runs, did scoring change? There's really no trends to say, well, pitching got worse. You know, you can tell because of the runs, because the runs really didn't follow that pattern. So anyway.
And when it comes to Rob Manfred getting something right, I'm always reminded of a saying my grandma used to use, which had to do with blind squirrels and finding acorns. You know, it happens every so often just by
clocks.
Accident.
Stop clocks, yeah.
Yeah, except in his case, a stop calendar, right? Okay, so let's move on, and I'll ask you guys what we learned in 2023 that we might be able to apply in 2024 as far as fantasy goes, and I'm going to start this one off, you guys. I think we'd been wondering for a while about the seeming evolution of the closer role in bullpens across the game. We were seeing saves being more widely distributed, and that was causing us to rethink how we were valuing those closers and stuff. But this year, we saw a pretty notable reversion back to more concentration of saves. Now, I'm working on a study of this year's bullpen usage for a Baseball HQ article in the offseason, but here are some of the early highlights. The saves as a percent of wins stayed right at 51%. That's the same for the last couple of years. The percent of saves by pitchers who had 30 saves or more went up to 32% of all saves from 27% last year. The percent of saves by pitchers with that 20 to 29 range almost doubled from 12 or so percent last year to 24 this year. And if you take all the pitchers who had 20 saves or more, they got way over half the saves this year, and it was 40% last year. So I think there is a concentration of saves that we're going to be seeing. And 63% of saves went to the team's closers. That's if we define closers as the saves leader per team, and that's up from 58% in 2022. Obviously, I think there's more research to be done to get a little more granular, but it looks like the mainstream closer is back, and I imagine that's going to cause some rethinking of how we approach relievers in drafts and in salary auction games. Ray, what do you say?
Yeah, that's a good point. It's entirely, we may have seen the peak of the non-closer era, and maybe we're ticking a little bit back in the other direction. So I'm always willing to see to see where a bell curve hits the trough and starts going the other way. And we might be at that point with the closers, which is cool. I contrast that to what Todd was saying earlier about starting pitching and what I was going to nominate as my key point here, which is the plethora of stolen bases and how we value them going forward. I think Todd had an off-air rant about that is probably going to get provoked here at some point. The trend in starting pitching is flattening. The trend in saves may be just past flat and going back a little bit toward the closer, as you say, Todd. But stolen bases are everywhere, and I think how we adapt to that is something that's going to take some real thought this offseason.
To sort of talk about your point, Patrick, and I'm hesitant to use 1 year and say this is the way it is. I don't know, and that was you probably talking about with the more granular studies. It just could be that the better closers didn't get hurt. It could be that teams started with a better closer in the role. So I don't know that the new trend. It may just be circumstance to this season, but it's certainly noteworthy that we're in that direction, and we have to think about it. What did I have? I have it written down. Oh yeah, what I have is the what we can learn. This is something we talked about, on Baseball HQ Radio over the past couple of years, but I think not everybody was buying in or understanding the how much it exert. Teams are calling minor leaguers up earlier and earlier, and we have to adjust our draft strategies to that. Whether it's AL only, NL only, and not keeping FAB money or kind of going a stars and a scrubs in a mixed league and replacing, you taking something. We have to think about how we want to take advantage of it. Having said that, I'm not a minor league guy. We both work with people that are much more in tune with this. I'm curious what people have to say at First Pitch Arizona, but I also think this was an exceptional year in that I still think we're seeing the tail end of a big pool of minor leaguers because of the 2020 loss of the season. So I think the pool of minor leaguers to choose from was bigger. I do think they're going to continue to be called up earlier, but I don't think we're going to have the volume. I don't know about you, Ray, but this is a year in a Strat-O-Matic rookie draft. I want as many picks as I can early because this draft's going to be deep.
Yeah, it is a bumper crop for guys who are going to have super long careers. Those Strat drafts, I'm not actually in a Strat or Sibley like that at the moment, but I still have my brain sort of wired for that space after doing it for so long, and appreciate it for sure. And is this still partially post-pandemic effect? I think probably, but let's not forget a lot has changed in the minors too. We've got smaller minor league systems, and the design of the minors is entirely different, and might be that the refined minor league org is just structured to get guys to the majors quicker, which, let's face it, that would be okay, right? For the most part, I think these guys are coming up and they're not all hitting the ground running, but they're not consistently overmatched either. It's not like teams are reaching down and pulling up guys just to fill spots that they don't think they're ready for. That's not what we're seeing. So, and then, there's obviously the incentives in the CBA to call up guys late in the season and get them their feet wet before being eligible for the Rookie of the Year award and the resulting bonus pool adjustments later on. So, I think you're right that some element of his pandemic effect, but I also think there are systemic effects that are here to stay.
Before we go on, I was just going to comment about stolen bases. I just think that they're going to go up next year. And the reason is I can't imagine that most front offices aren't alerting their managers to the fact that every stolen base that you don't take is a run that you don't score or a part of a run that you don't score. And it's becoming increasingly obvious with what's the stolen base percentage was up over 75% this year, 76%.
Well, that's the normal.
Close to 80, wasn't it?
Yeah. Oh, it's closer to 80, yeah. Okay, so that means whatever that run matrix is that has to do with stolen bases, they're just blowing past it to the point where anybody who can steal a base should be encouraged to steal a base all the time, because 8 times out of 10, you're improving your run situation. There are tactical reasons and game situation reasons not to, but for the most part, the teams that aren't stealing bases are really not helping themselves, and I wonder if that's going to change next year, and I expect it's going to, because everybody wants to score more runs.
Unless we go to the robo umps and the catchers don't have to worry about framing and they can set themselves up to get rid of the ball quicker. I hope they go to a challenge system, which so therefore you're still going to have a catcher catch and, you know, use your challenges as you wish. But I don't know it'll be next year. I don't think robo umps come in this quickly, but as soon as we get set in the stolen base, you know, atmosphere, landscape, things may change because catchers will now be trained to throw them out again. So we'll see.
And that's kind of where I come down too. I think you're right, PD, that next year the trend continues, but I think the rebound effect has to come at some point. Maybe it'll take a year or two longer than that, because I think these kind of adjustments organizationally can't be made quite as quickly. But in terms of teaching pitchers to better hold runners to the extent they're even allowed to, and teaching catchers to throw better, or prioritizing development in your organization of defense first catchers who can control the running game, I think there has to be a counter adjustment coming. But maybe we'll see some of that this offseason, but I think largely that'll take a little bit longer for orgs to identify those talents and redirect them in that way. So I wouldn't be surprised if you're right and the next step is even more stolen bases before we get some whiplash.
Yeah.
And Ray, when you talk about the change in the call-up rules in the CBA and stuff, and this was going to be my most meaningful rule change, so I'll just skip that when we get to it next. But I'm curious what you think about the effect that this is going to have on those sort of borderline late career veterans who are all of a sudden not going to have a spot on a roster because it's going to be taken by the next Spencer Steer or Gunnar Henderson or somebody like that. And we already saw it this year, in fact, with a few players. Jorge Mateo was pretty close to kicked off the team. It ended up being like the last guy on the bench in a pinch runner type of thing. This is going to skew the salary system, I think, in Major League Baseball. And I wonder if you think that's going to have any effects on fantasy situations.
Yeah, it might. It's a good point, because if you think about, you know, the one that comes to mind from this past spring is, just off the top of my head, say Nelson Cruz with the Padres. Like, yeah, sure, we'll give him a month to see if there's anything left in the tank. And if there isn't, you know, we'll cut him and we'll, you know, that'll be conveniently a month before we can call up a prospect or somebody else to that roster spot. But now if the incentive is to have the rookie on the opening day roster, you would think it's
which it is.
You would think that it's the last gasp of Nelson Cruz that is most likely to get squeezed off the roster. And to your point, for even the 1 month, Nelson Cruz would have made a lot more money than the 20-year-old. So the clubs are saving money in that regard. But, you know, in theory, this was by design from the union. They wanted more money to be pushed toward the younger players. And if it's a zero-sum game, the money has to come from somebody else. And the money's coming from, in this case, Nelson Cruz. And if the union did that with their eyes open, then sort of by definition, they must be fine with it.
Yeah, and most of the veterans who are going to be affected will have had a reasonably long career and will have cashed more than their share of paychecks and done pretty well and getting new young players into the game. I wonder if the union's long-term goal is to get those salaries up as well. I think it is. Where instead of coming in at 700 grand, they're going to come in at 1.5 million or something like that, so that the pressure is on, because the agents can go into the clubs and say, well, if Gunnar Henderson's worth 1.5 million, then what is Mike Trout worth? Assuming that Mike Trout's not hurt all the time, or what is any one of these young players who's coming into his arbitration or free agent years? I think it might be a very clever way to start pushing up salaries from the bottom instead of waiting, as they have for years, to have Alex Rodriguez set the high level and everybody gets sucked along up behind it because they put in all these salary cap and salary restraints and stuff like that. Maybe the union's looking at starting the general salary increases at the bottom of the game rather than the top.
Exactly, because those, you know, minimum salaries, et cetera, are, you know, statutory. They're not prone to the whims of the GM giving out the, you know, too big of a contract. And for sure, I think we've, by and large, in the aggregate, given credit to the MLB clubs for not making those big dollar mistakes with players in their 30s as much as they did 10, 15, 20 years ago. Although I will confess, I was looking at Yu Darvish's contract today, and clearly we've not eradicated those over 30 contract mistakes.
When I started thinking about this, my thoughts ran to Dave Potts and what is this going to do to his eternal strategy of boring old veterans, because there may not be any anymore except for the guys who are really worth quite a lot.
We have veterans in spring training walking around with cups, you know, will DH for food, you know?
Well, speaking of rule changes, I mentioned mine, so I'll pass. But which rule changes out of all the rule changes turned out to be the most meaningful? Ray, let's start with you.
I think extending Todd's earlier point, meaningful both for reasons we saw and reasons we may not yet have fully quantified, I think it's got to be the clock. I think the clock just kind of was an overlaid factor on top of all the other rule changes. And I'll throw the pace of play rules between the clock and the minimum number of throws over and the single timeout and all those sorts of things. Just that unlocked to me the stolen base gains. It also unlocked all of those time of game things. And Todd talked about the non-fantasy reasons why those have been good for the game, and I am not indifferent to those. Let me just quickly renew my rant for my Think Our midseason meeting when I said, okay, now that we've got game time down to 2 hours and 30 minutes, can we not start every game at 7 o'clock local time? Can we spread them out, or can we maybe throw a couple of seconds back on the clock? Like, I don't want every game over before 10 o'clock Eastern time every night. It drives me nuts.
Todd, what do you think? Which rule change turned out to be the most important?
All right, so I'm gonna give what I feel the second most, because Ray kind of covered what I say, and I think this is an important thing to think about, in that we haven't talked. It's really not a rules change, but the different schedule between the more balanced schedule and having more off days. You can cherry pick instances where more teams from the same division, this may be more of a real baseball, I'll get to the fantasy in a moment. You know, you may be able to pick, this division's really strong and had a lot of teams. We had more, possibility of three teams from the same division making the playoffs this year than any other year, because you're not getting beat up. You're beating up outside the division, and that your record within division, they're a lot closer. But the extra off days, I don't know, Ray, how much you've gotten into this yet. And again, I don't want to make a knee-jerk reaction off of 1 year, but the number of players that have like over 680, over 700, over 720 plate appearances, we're back to like 10, 12 years ago. And I think it has to do with the more off days, so that teams can just built in refresh days for some of their players. Plus, maybe they didn't get hurt. But when we talk about skills being a science, I think there's more science to playing time that we really haven't. We being everybody, not just me and you. I think everybody, the industry, the community in general, has not really taken a look at the science of playing time. It's like on an individual basis. You know, no one has ever done this. Well, this guy's about to, and how can I say he won't when he's done this so far? Well, no one ever has. Well, we don't care. We're going to give that guy, we're going to give Semien 720 plate appearances again, because he's done it like, every year but the pandemic year.
I had a Marcus Semien rant later on. I'll save it for then. But let me throw into this discussion that I think the other aspect of this that relates to it is a rule change not from this year but a couple of years ago, and I think some of that ties back to the universal DH. Obviously, we've had that for a couple of years, but I think we've gotten to the point now where teams have almost universally gotten away from having a full-time DH on their roster, and everyone's using the DH spot for player health and resting reasons, and that's helping everyone max out their plate appearances.
I think that's right. You see it everywhere. And I as soon as you said that, I started trying to think who was a full-time DH anywhere in baseball this year.
Yeah, even Kyle Schwarber had to wear gloves
once in a while. Yeah,
You know, you get Bryce Harper, but it was because of right. needs.
Yeah,
you know, right. and this feeds into the old man
Ohtani,
thing too.
That's it. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. And again, because of needs, this feeds into the you know the old man thing. You know, the Red Sox have a bit of a conundrum. The Phillies, you know, they're be sure like to have a DH available to rotate guys through, but some of their best fielders should be DHs. So you know, it will be interesting.
It will be. Guys, this has been really interesting so far. Let's take a quick break. We'll come back in just a second. We'll move on to the players in 2023. You're listening to Baseball HQ Radio.
De La Cruz goes. Pitch called a strike. Thrown out on a skip late. Another steal for Ellie De La Cruz. That's his 14th swipe, caught just twice in the show. He takes off again. Pitch down and in. Fame throw. There's no chance. No. Two steals.
De La Cruz had already looked a couple of times at Brian Anderson, knowing that if he got a jump.
He's going home. The throw. He stole home. The most thrilling man in baseball stole second, third, and home.
Baseball HQ Radio.
And welcome back to Baseball HQ Radio. I'm Patrick Davitt. That sound clip, of course, the most exciting play of the 2023 season, at least as far as I saw it. Ellie De La Cruz of Cincinnati stealing second, third, and home in two pitches at Milwaukee on July the 8th in an 8-5 Reds win. Now we're back with Ray Murphy of Baseball HQ in your left headphone or speaker, and Todd Zola of Masters Ball, ESPN, SiriusXM, and RotoWire in your right. It's our end-of-season roundtable edition. We discussed the big stories of Major League Baseball and Fantasy Baseball in Part 1. And now in Part 2, we'll talk about the players from 2023. And we'll start with our disappointments. And we'll kick off with a fantasy bust hitter and Todd Zola.
All right. So this, you know, personally, I don't want to have injuries. Guy could have gotten hurt, but if he was kind of terrible before he got hurt, I don't disqualify him from my discussion. So looking at what I expected and what they produced, the one to me the most disappointing hitter that was supposed to produce and really didn't get hurt was Manny Machado, San Diego. And he, you know, three stolen bases. He was one of the guys we thought, hey, maybe Machado can take advantage of the rules and hit 10 or 12 this year. And he had 9 out of 10 last year. He stole three bags all year. 253 average. I don't have the nuts and bolts numbers. It was just a disappointing year. And there were some people that pushed Machado and other third basemen up the board on the perceived scarcity aspect of the position. So that just further feeds into the level of disappointment that Manny Machado fantasy managers experienced this season.
Well, as you guys know, I use a formula that adds the yearly profit to the actual production to create what I call net fantasy value. And by that measure, and I know there's a bit of an injury problem here too, but Tim Anderson of the White Sox is my fantasy bust for 2023.
Yeah.
Of course, most fantasy managers would have drafted Anderson mainly for a power and speed combination, but especially for batting average certainty. He won a batting title in 2019. He's been over 300 the last four seasons, albeit in a kind of declining pattern. Instead, Tim Anderson was 250, 13 stolen bases, and one home run. He was a sixth rounder, $23 in Tout AL, 19 in Tout Mixed. And by Baseball HQ's valuation, he was about a $6 player this season, so around minus 10 in net fantasy value. To me, that's just a huge disappointment. Ray Murphy.
I got a couple of nominees that center around the same theme. I'm going to throw Dalton Varsho on the pile, though. His year may not look like a complete disaster relative to your formula there, PD. He had 222.
Oh, it's pretty good.
with 20 home runs and 16 stolen bases. I mean, it doesn't sound bad, but he's another one that for scarcity reasons, like Todd said, at the catcher pool got pushed up quite a bit on draft boards back in March, and just really disappointing from that aspect. The other part of it that really made it worse is the long-standing dearth of talent at the catching position is no longer a problem. The catcher was full of profit centers this year, and you were so much better off grabbing one of those later in the draft, as opposed to paying up for Varsho. And it also seemed like those 16 stolen bases at the catching position were such a leg up. 16 stolen bases are barely worth getting out of bed for anymore, which is a huge part of what ruined Varsho's value in this landscape. So, and then of course, looking ahead, the next nail in the coffin for Varsho's value will be him losing catcher eligibility next year. So all in all, I got less than I wanted from Dalton Varsho, and I'm pretty sure for all of the above reasons, he will not be on any of my teams next year.
Well, unless defense counts, because he was actually a really effective defensive outfielder for the Jays, which is one of the reasons that they picked him up, and to be a left-handed bat, which was not didn't work out nearly as well as they were going to say. I saw Dalton Varsho got drafted in the seventh round of a 2024 early draft, and I said, that's
a mistake. I'm comfortable saying that.
Even if, I mean, you could justify it if he was eligible catcher and say he's going to rebound. But, you know, I mean, I kind of giggle when you said Varsho, because in my head I'm thinking, well, Varsho and Alejandro Kirk split my bust votes. So I went with somebody else, because I had them both. You know, which
well,
is a
Kirk
bigger
is a bigger bust, obviously.
Well, yeah.
Has or was. But, let's get that straight.
I thought they both, you know, I am, we're not talking fantasy playoffs or playoffs, but man, those Blue Jays, if you look, you know, if you set aside what they did not do, you look at the roster, what they can do, they could win the whole thing. You know, it has to come together, but we just did a piece for ESPN about who, you know, betting odds, who's got the best odds, and, you know, based on odds, it's like, you get some nice odds and a lot of Blue Jays, and will they come together? They're not, it's not like they flipped the switch previously and shown they could do it. But again, on paper, they could win the whole thing.
Well, they've got everything they need. They can score runs. If everybody hits, they can score runs. And certainly they've got pitching that should be fairly solid compared to a lot of their opponents. Speaking of pitching, move on to our fantasy bust pitchers. And, I'll start this one, and even though I made up my own rules, I don't know if I'm allowed to take the entire White Sox rotation or the entire St. Louis rotation, I guess, for that matter. But since we're focusing on individual players, I'm going to go with Dylan Cease of the White Sox, so both of my bust players are from the South Side. Cease was a late third, early fourth rounder. He went for $24 in tout, 19 in tout mixed, and he had a minus $2 season by HQ valuation. 4.66 ERA, 1.42 WHIP, 27% K rate was good, but 10% walks wasn't. A little bit of misfortune here and there with runners in scoring position, that kind of stuff. But he was really bad in August, 26 earned runs in 29 innings. So a bust for this year, but a second place in the 2021 Cy with a bit of control improvement. I think Dylan Cease might be underdrafted next year and could present a bit of a bargain opportunity for those who are stout of heart. Ray, what do you think?
Yeah, I think I would kind of like to see what the team context looks like next year. It looks like the black cloud over the White Sox might last more than one season. I'll stay close to Dylan Cease with my own pick. I'm going to go with Lucas Giolito, who had a, you know, as a reminder, had a bad 2022 with a 4.90 ERA and a 1.44 WHIP. But by the time March came around, was regarded as a rebound candidate. That didn't happen at all. He followed up his 4.90 ERA with a 4.88 ERA. Still at 200 strikeouts, but the bad team context with the White Sox, the Angels, and so on led to an 8-15 record, which, you know, amounted to a $1 season. This guy is still 28, and I wouldn't be surprised if someone pays him a decent amount of money this year. But, for anybody who went looking for that Lucas Giolito rebound this year, it was not to be found.
Todd, who's your bust pitcher?
All right, so I hinted at it by saying, you know, the guy, if he gets injured or whatever, if he stunk beforehand, he still stunk. For as much as one could go good for Toronto, not everything went well for the Toronto Blue Jays. And maybe it was just my overly high expectations for Alex Manoa. But, I mean, to me, this should be named the Alex Manoa Award forever and ever and ever. Whether it was the pitch clock or whatever it was just terrible. And sending the minors to get his head straight, and he was just terrible. So, you know, the bulldog mentality, he was such a great interview. Well, I'm going to take some shares because I'm the donkey in this whole thing. But he was, and maybe because I had him valued so high and waiting on pitching, he's going to be my guy, and he didn't work out. Now, with Dylan Cease, to me, he wasn't a bust because I wasn't that high on him. So it's kind of the reverse.
Well, that's where I am on Manoah.
Manoah is more of a bust.
Yeah.
Because I was on that other end of, you know, he, all right, I know he doesn't have the K rate, but if I squint, I can see where it's going to get better. So maybe this is more about me, but Manoah was terrible.
Manoah was terrible. And I would have taken him, except it seemed like shooting fish in a barrel and I had to go first. So I wanted to make sure that somebody could get a hold of Alec Manoah at the end. There's a lot of, I live in the Toronto media market, and there's a lot of rumors and speculation about what was going on with Alec Manoah. And there was some scuttlebutt that he was arguing with the team about how he was being treated, and they were pushing back saying, you're not participating in your own recovery to the extent that you need to. It was a very messy situation. And I wonder if maybe the best thing for his fantasy value and his real value might be a change of scenery, if somebody's willing to take a chance on him. Unfortunately, if you're Toronto, you're trading at the absolute bottom of the market. So it might not be the easiest thing in the world to do. Let's move on to our awards for 2023 fantasy baseball season. And let's start with the rookie of the year, Ray Murphy. Who's your first year star of stars?
In a year where Ronald Acuna didn't exist, we might all be talking about Corbin Carroll and what he did as a rookie. He's my easy choice here. 285 batting average, 25 home runs, 54 stolen bases, a near $40 season, depending on your exact calculations, a top five roto value season from a 22-year-old in his first full season. Checks all the boxes for me. Easy fantasy rookie of the year.
Wow, I'm embarrassed. When I went through my list to check out the rookies, I completely forgot Carroll was a rookie. And I said, someone's going to take Gunnar Henderson. So I want to talk about Spencer Steer. So Spencer Steer, I have written down, I will. It was close enough with Henderson that I don't feel it's slighting Gunnar Henderson. Besides, there's one more chance for Gunnar to get in mention. But you know, with all the hype about De La Cruz and towards the end, you know, Encarnacion Strand and everything, Matt McClain, had he not gotten hurt, could have been my choice. Spencer Steer was Mr. Steady. Don't overlook first and third eligibility nowadays. Any multiple eligibility is good. When they call this guy up, Steer's the odd man out. No, let's just put him in left field and he'll be fine. So I think Spencer Steer, because I'm not, Corbin, yeah. But I'm going to go Steer as, you know, if we can't repeat answers, Spencer Steer is my guy.
Well, here I am going third, and I thought to myself, well, I bet Ray takes Corbin Carroll. It's like playing a draft. I said, Ray will take Corbin Carroll for sure. That'll leave Todd taking Gunnar Henderson for sure, either of which I would have taken. So I said, the most exciting rookie this season was clearly Ellie De La Cruz of Cincinnati, but the most valuable rookie was his teammate, Spencer Steer. So I don't need to really go through a lot of what Todd said, because Todd's already said it. He did. Steer did actually out-earn everybody in my net fantasy value calculation. I also thought the position versatility was really important for the Reds, but also for fantasy managers. And the Reds really liked him in their offense. He batted third in 28% of his plate appearances. He batted cleanup in 23% of his plate appearances, and he batted fifth in 15%. So 2/3 of his plate appearances were in run-producing positions. And that's something that you really have to be looking for these days when you're assessing players for your draft purposes. Where are they hitting in the lineup? In fact, Baseball HQ has devoted quite a few resources to figuring that out and putting it out there for people to realize where the batting order positions are. Well, let's move on to our 2023 Fantasy Cy Young Awards. Todd Zola, who's the best pitcher in fantasy baseball this year?
Well, I usually go best pitcher, but I actually did a little value thing here, mainly because that, as kind of talked about, there wasn't this guy. There wasn't a pitcher that just leaps and bounds above what we expected, or even you know Cole and Strider were drafted first round. I think if you picked up Zach Eflin,
oh, geez.
You had a pretty – oh, we did it again. A couple of years ago, you asked for our answers. So I went with Zach Eflin. Strike, you know, kind of strike out just enough to be dangerous, and then he had – wasn't 200 innings, but it was like 170 or 180, something in that range. And, you know, nice whip. And you, some of these guys that aren't lower on the chain, you kind of lose some of their starts until you trust them. But with Eflin pitching in Tampa for that team, kind of trust him from the beginning, you know. So you didn't lose, you know. Justin Steele maybe had a lot of those good starts on the bench, or Cole Reagans, you had those good starts on the bench before you trusted him. Kind of trust Eflin or any Tampa pitcher from the jump.
Well, to the surprise of absolutely no one, Todd seems to have somehow hacked my computer and pulled out my fantasy award files, because I too went with Zach Eflin fairly narrowly over Felix Bautista of Baltimore, who had a really, really terrific year as a closer from a relatively low spot. Most of the top closers were going a little bit earlier than he was. But yeah, I had to go with Zach Eflin as well. The whip around one, mid threes ERA. And he did all that from like a 17th round ADP or something like that. Those are the kind of guys who win you championships. When you get a Zach Eflin performance from an 18th round pick, or for $3 at the end of an auction, I don't think that I can disagree with Todd there. Well, obviously, I didn't disagree with Todd. I'm agreeing with Todd. Ray, are you agreeing with both of us?
I'm agreeing with you in the structure or profile of the guy, but I got a different name for you.
Good.
Than Eflin. I'm going to go with Kyle Bradish, who did a lot of what you're talking about with Eflin, and except that Bradish's return probably came from the waiver wire rather than even an endgame draft pick. You know, 169 innings, strikeout an inning, 283 ERA, 104 whip. Those numbers are just gorgeous, along with 12 wins, 18 quality starts, and 30 game starts. And I'll be honest, I thought he was a smoke and mirrors guy for most of the year. But I sit here on the day after the season's over and look at the skills. They're pretty darn good. You know, 7% walk rate against a 25% strikeout rate, a BPV of 125. Better than that in the second half. He was a 218 ERA and a sub one whip in the second half. I mean, super impressive season, you know, and really even more out of nowhere than Eflin. So I'll go with Bradish.
We all think of Tampa as being a pitching development hotbed, and Cleveland as well, but should we start thinking about Baltimore in the same way? They seem to be doing very well with some cast-off-y type of guys.
Yes, I think that's part of it. And then getting back to Todd's point, you know, with the flattened schedule, you don't have to be as terrified of pitching in the AL East or whatever the beast division of the year is. It's more normalized, and you know, that left field in Camden Yards certainly helps too.
Yeah, that's right. They pushed that fence back so far that I think they did it for John Means, but it turned out maybe to help have helped everybody.
They pushed it back to Delaware, PD.
All right, let's move on to our fantasy most valuable hitter. And I get to go first, which means I get to be the first guy to say Ronald Acuna Jr. And my net value method usually comes up with a guy like Washington outfielder Lane Thomas, a $3 player who gets $25 of value. You add the $22 value to the $25 profit, you get a $47 net fantasy value. And that's usually enough to win this particular little contest. But even by that standard, you guys, Acuna lapped the field. A near $60 season, actually over $60 now at Baseball HQ, on a $35-ish projection. So you're looking at a net fantasy value well into the $80 range. The only player even within $25 of Acuna was his teammate, first baseman Matt Olson, who had a near $60 net fantasy value, but this year didn't even get him close. Even if we didn't give Acuna the $25 profit, he'd still win this contest. So that's the kind of year that Ray alluded to when we started this exercise. And the other guys who are over 50, Corbin Carroll, Cody Bellinger, and none of these guys is going to be profitable next year. But Acuna might be, unless somebody's willing to bid $70 in an auction. Ray.
I'm going to go with the only guy, thank you to Ryan Bloomfield for this statistic, the only guy who returned first-round value this year from outside the top 150 ADP, so outside of the first 10 rounds and the 15-teamer. That's Cody Bellinger, 307 batting average, 26 homers, 20 stolen bases, 97 RBIs, You'll famously remember from last offseason when he wanted to bet on himself and sign only a one-year contract. Well, that worked out pretty well. I'm not going to lie. I might be looking a little harder at somebody who tries to go that route this year after the bad years that Bellinger had leaving LA, coming off of injury. But clearly he's healthy. Clearly he figured out, the well-chronicled swing changer got back to something that worked for him. And he came in right around 15th in our end of season values, like I said, from an ADP of down in the 180s. Cody Bellinger.
And Todd.
Well, all right, Acuña's the guy. Fantasy leagues should make up a prize. Everybody put $5 in the pool. And the team that came in second the team that finished the highest without Acuña should win that pool. And that's just, I had him in the 70s in mixed leagues. That's just silly. So he was my guy, but I'm going to go down the list and I'm going to just to name another name, someone that at least we should recognize. And to me, Nico Hoerner is someone who, this is more just a way to point out Nico Hoerner had a really nice season. Bellinger's teammate stole over 40 bases. I'm sure we're all going to do studies. Where did the stolen bases come from? And Hoerner, why did he jump up, in that range? Would have had 10 homers or double-digit homers if he hadn't gotten hurt. So I'm going to recognize Nico Hoerner's really strong season, even though Acuña's the winner.
And again, we're talking about a guy who was not anywhere near the top rounds in drafts and certainly would have been a profit in auction sort of games. All right, boys, let's move on to part three. We're looking ahead now to 2024. And we'll call these our boons and banes for 2024 in keeping with Baseball HQ Radio's nomenclature. Ray Murphy, start us off. Who's a boon hitter for next year?
I think my early hobby horse for answer to this question, based on my minimal research to date, is CJ Abrams of the Nats. And that's mostly related to what he did in the second half. I think PD, you and I might have talked at some point on the pod about that July series with the Reds, where Ellie De La Cruz went to town on the Nationals, was just running wild, and you just pictured Davey Martinez going down to Abrams on the bench and saying, "Hey, you could be that guy too." And CJ's like, "Oh, okay, really? That's what I'm supposed to do?" And from there, he just went nuts. Abrams' second half, 38 stolen bases, 11 home runs. Most encouragingly, doubled his walk rate, more than doubled it from 3% to 7%. Contact rate from 75% to 82%. Hard contact went above average to 105. So he's putting the bat on the ball more. We know the wheels are there. He's aggressive on the bases. Give me a little bit more depth or bulk to the Nationals lineup next year behind him, and I think all systems are go for a CJ Abrams explosion next year, like second half times two.
Todd, who's your guy?
All right, I got a new guy.
Hopefully, I talked long enough for you.
No, I got a new guy. No, it didn't take me long. Ha-Seong Kim, 17 homers, 38 steals, hit .260. Batting average improved. I know I need to look under the hood to see if it's going to continue to get better. He's going to play. Knock on wood, he'll play shortstop for the Padres next year. Looking at the position eligibility, he goes into the season eligible second, third, and shortstop. That's it huge. Is. And he's going to play. And I don't know if he'll hit the top of the order. Depends what San Diego does. But I think a lot of people, because of the extent of what Abrams did towards the end, he's kind of on radar. I don't know if Ha-Seong Kim is on the radar as much as he should be at this point. So I'm going to give my boon to Ha-Seong Kim.
And I'm going to go with CJ Abrams. I spent a lot of time looking at this too. I thought there's no way any of these guys is going to take CJ Abrams. And of course, there's Ray. Well, I'll start with CJ Abrams. Okay, well, I do have a couple of notes I can throw in to up the case for CJ Abrams. Most analysts agree, you guys, that max EV is a useful indicator of power potential, better than average EV. And Abrams was 113 miles an hour, which is 70th percentile-ish. Spencer Torkelson, Santander, Teoscar Hernandez, guys like that, which is pretty good company to be keeping if you're sort of aspiring to hit some more home runs. And then 47 stolen bases this season, and the ceiling is even higher if he could just get on base a little more. And as Ray said, if we look at his second half, it seems fairly likely that he's going to get on base a little more. He was 6-for-7 stealing third in 2023, and he might be emboldened to try that a little more often as well, and they say it's easier. And a couple of other things, he was in the first half, and when he was having the struggles, he was batting 8th and 9th in that Washington batting order. They moved him to leadoff just to kind of give him a goose, I think. Listen to this, 16% strikeout rate once he got into the top spot, down 7 points from what he was doing before. His 7% walk rate was more than almost double. 749 OPS was up 60 points or so, and his on-base percentage, just talked about that, 319. So he gained 31 points of on-base percentage when he was hitting higher in the order. And the only other thing I'll mention is a few years ago, Baseball HQ ran a research article, I don't remember who wrote it, that the place to make your breakout bets was the year after the season in which a young player reached 800 plate appearances. And at the end of this year, CJ Abrams has just over 900 plate appearances. So perhaps most importantly, he's got that floor or that foundation of plate appearances that we can start to more rely on, and he's going to turn 23 in a couple of days on Wednesday of this week. So I remembered a speed first shortstop who had 27 home runs combined in his ages 21 to 22 seasons. Then he crossed over that 800 plate appearance threshold during the age 22 season. Then age 23, a 3-year run of 33 homers, 38 homers, 32 homers, and mid 20 stolen bases in all 3 years. And that player was Francisco Lindor. And I bet Abrams is still going to go 6th, 7th rounds unless he gets talked up in the preseason. And I would sure take a young Francisco Lindor in the 6th or 7th round, that's for sure. Let's move over to the mound. How about a 2024 Boone pitcher, Todd Zola?
I tweeted this out. Who am I going to overdraft next year, and why is it Tarek Skubal? Maybe he pitched so well that he's going to get that helium. But, you know, concerned about the innings a little bit. But I was so impressed just watching, not just the numbers, watching him pitch. The competition wasn't the greatest. But the question, what could this guy do if he keeps the ball in the yard? The answer is win a Cy Young. And if he can get enough innings next year, I think it, only good things for Tarek Skubal.
Well, I was going to take Cole Reagans, and then I thought, well, I'll leave Cole Reagans because Todd will take him or Ray will take him, and I'll take Detroit left-hander Tarek Skubal. So at this point, either Todd or I is completely unnecessary in this particular podcast. We're just treading over the same ground repeatedly, but I'll just throw in some stats from 2020 through 2023. Tarek Skubal's ERA is first digit 5.432. His expected ERA estimator is 4.332. His whips, 12.19, 12.59, 11.56, 09.17 in 2023. Strikeouts minus walks, 19, 19, 18, 27 this year. Ground ball rates, 28, 38, 46, 52. This guy's doing something very, very right in the latter part of this year, and I think it's really interesting. His WOBA over the 4 years, 337, 332, 289, 241 this year. So everything seems to be going right for Tarek Skubal. I think maybe it's related to the surgery he had in the middle of last year, and it kept him out the 3 months of this year. Actually, his first start came on Independence Day, so I guess we could say he was reborn on the 4th of July. Above average fastball, great pitching stuff all over the place. Tarek Skubal, I think Todd is right. He's the guy to look for next year. Ray, who do you like?
I'll go out to somebody different since you guys are all singing from the same hymnal here. I'm going to go with Ryan Pepiot, the Dodgers. I remember back in the first half of this season, the Dodgers were pulling everyone but PD Todd and me to come in and pitch as the rotation was getting decimated. But Pepiot wasn't available. He was hurt too down in the minors. So it took forever for him to actually get up and help out the Dodgers, and to the point where he was almost forgotten about. But as a result of that, people may not have noticed what he did late in the season in sort of a swingman role for the Dodgers. 42 innings, 5 walks to 38 strikeouts, a 2.14 ERA. There is some pedigree here. We know the Dodgers know how to develop pitching. Pepiot had, if I remember correctly, it was a hip injury or something that cost him most of the first half of the season. So to me, this is a breakout delayed, but not a breakout denied. I'm super excited to see what he can do when he, I think, almost inevitably ends up plugged into the Dodger rotation right from opening day next year, Ryan Pepiot.
Not the worst team context either.
Pretty good. Pretty darn good.
Pretty decent team. Let's go to our Baines 2024 Bane hitter. I get to go first, which means I'm not going to get sniped for a change. And I'm going to take Bo Bichette of Toronto. Everybody's breathing a sigh of relief. He was 29, 25, 102 in 2021, 29 homers, 25 stolen bases. And he's been drafted every year since on that same expectation, but he's just not that player. His home runs per 650 plate appearances in that breakout season was 27. Since then, 22 last year, 22 this year. Stolen bases have vanished. He's had pretty good counting stats due to an almost eerie ability to make contact. He's like third percentile chase rate, 13th percentile walks, 70th percentile whiff rate. He doesn't walk, but he hits the ball everywhere, and he hits it hard. And because he's willing to spray the ball all over the place, his BABIPs and the BA that results have always been pretty high. And you have to say they're justified if you watch this guy hit, because he'll reach out. He's almost like Vladimir Guerrero Sr., hitting balls off his ankles and hitting balls that are 2 feet inside and getting wood on them. You know, he's getting the barrel on it. And he's been productive by staying on the field at close to 700 plate appearances the last couple of years, but I think we have to start wondering about that too. He's barely over 600 plate appearances this year because of a knee injury. His knee just locked up while he was running from first to second, and he's had a quad injury as well. So when guys start getting those leg injuries, I don't know. And defensively, he's been terrible. He's like one of the worst defensive shortstops in baseball. I saw someone in the web said Bichette might be closer to Xander Bogaerts than Trey Turner in value. And for me, guys, that seems about right. Ray, who's your Bane hitter?
It's time for my Marcus Semien rant. Let's go. Todd, you made a good point earlier about how we're seeing more players post these big PA totals thanks to the schedule, the DH, those factors that we talked about. But Semien's on another planet. I mean, going back to 2019, we'll put aside the shortened 2020 season, but he's four straight full seasons over 700 PAs. This year, he put up 752 following two straight years of 724. Clearly, playing every day is a skill for him. However, he's going to be 33 next year. Time waits for nobody. I'm not even sure they should let him play that much. My point here is the underlying skills are good, not great. I think we all know the 45 home runs from 2021 isn't coming back. There are still plenty of above average skills in this skill set, but the only thing he is elite at is playing time. And I don't want to bank on that at age 33 and beyond. So Marcus Semien's a bane of mine for next year.
The only thing I'll say about that is when he moved to Toronto, the media could not get over the fact that this guy works out harder than anybody's ever seen. He's like 6 hours a day in the gym, and I think maybe you can stave off Father Time. I don't know what the cost of Marcus Semien is going to be next year, and it'll be interesting to see who's willing to pay it. Todd, what do you think of Marcus Semien or your own Bane hitter?
Real quick with Semien, the other thing with him, with Semien, is you mentioned the 45 homers. He, you know, the whole StatCast lucky metric, he is just such a dead pull hitter. He hits so many fly balls right down the line that are deemed lucky. Now, is it one of those things where because he does it so often, that's a skill he owns, is to hit fly balls right down the line and get the home runs? But it seems to me, Ray, that could be a, you know, as he gets older, you know, lose a little fly ball distance.
Yep.
And he loses the home runs as well. So I'm with you. Now, I'm actually on a teammate of Semien's as far as my boon goes. No, Bane, my Bane. He was a boon this year, but he's now a Bane. And that's Corey Seager. And he's going to get the, you know, yep, it worked. The shift, it's all because of the shift. Maybe it helped him, but I don't think his average adjusted to 327 without the shift. you know, we all did our adjustments, Ray, but I don't think you landed on Seager should have hit 327 over the past 5 years.
No, so we were I think the high projection system on him, but we were like 305. Yeah.
Yeah. And I was pretty high, and I had him, you know, I like I said, he was a bane for me this year. The other thing with Seager, and if you go into the strictly, you know, value numbers and, you know, earnings, et cetera, he was really high because of his runs in RBI. If you prorate it to a full season, he missed some time. It was 120 runs, 130 RBI. And that is really high. And a lot of that has to do with early in the season, Texas's, the Rangers' batting average, what is the scoring position, was unholy lucky. And it normalized. And that's one of the reasons why the team, until they kind of put it together last week, was sputtering. Is that their batting average scoring position regressed to where it should. And their pitching got injured and just couldn't help it out. So a lot of those, to me, again, so the runs in RBI are bloated because of Texas's early just good luck. You know, he happened to come up with runners in scoring position, and he delivered. So I like Corey Seager, but I suspect he's going to be a first to second rounder. We can get steals later, and I like to think I have him in a keeper league or two because I was into him, but you know, as far as labor, et cetera, I think he's going to be overpriced.
And a 2024 bane pitcher, Ray Murphy, who you got?
Sort of the opposite side of sort of the same durability argument. I'm going to go with Tyler Glass now, who answered a lot of questions this year by coming off the IL after missing most of April and May and being relatively healthy and making 21 starts in the last two thirds of the season, carrying a, you know, what is nearly a regular full starter's workload in front of that Tampa rotation. And he did it effectively with a 3.58 ERA and 1.08 whip. But I am afraid that after seeing 85 innings in the second half, 120 for the season, that people are going to react and think that it's now time to take the restrictor plate off of Tyler Glass now and start projecting 150, 175 innings for him. The 120 this year are a career high, and he hadn't been over 100 since 2018. I'm not willing to give Tyler Glass now credit for being able to even follow up with another 120 inning season, let alone push that number up by 30 or 50 more innings. So if the price point on Glass now assumes, say, 160 innings next year, I'm out.
Todd, you in, you out, and who you got?
Yeah, Glasnow's tough. I'm probably out because I think people draft ratios and they don't think about the innings as much. And, you know, we can backfill while he's out. We can backfill him. But I think there's a risk with Glasnow at what he's going to cost. All right. Anybody who's been following my Twitter feed knows my answer here. And I had the gall to point out that Spencer Strider has pitched better than Blake Snell this year. All right, he may not have the same outcomes as Blake Snell, but by all measures, he has pitched better. And my point was, why are we handing Snell the Cy Young without even considering Snell? And what was pointed out to me, and I didn't consider this. And if someone wants to say the Cy Young should be about outcomes, I will disagree, but we haven't, it's an opinion, and that's fine. You want to convince me that Blake Snell's control is so good that he knows when to walk guys and when to go after guys, and that's why his strikeout, that's why his walk rate's so high? I can't hear it. And that's what people were saying, that you got to watch him pitch. He pitches around guys. That he strikes the next guy out. No, he doesn't. It's just been an insane year where it just everything's gone his way. 92% strand or left on bait, whatever you want to call it. It's just, you know, I mean, he's good, but you could be people. There's two things to say here. A, you can be good and lucky, which he is. And we're still overrating or putting too much exertion on a pitcher's ability to induce weak contact. There's more ability than we thought there was back in the McCracken days, dips theory, et cetera. There is more, but it's not to the extent some people are giving credit for. So anyway, Blake, I'm not going anywhere near Blake Snell in drafts next year.
Assuming that he's going to go at the usual cost or the heightened cost based on this year, I agree with you, Todd.
I will just jump in with one thing there about Snell. I agree with everything you said, Todd. I will, just in the interest of data, point out that for somebody who's got a lousy walk rate like he does, he has a pretty darn good first pitch strike rate, which generally is supposed to be a leading indicator for walks, maybe not the best leading indicator.
It doesn't. Yeah, it's. Oh, all right. I'm sorry. You said walks. I should have been quiet. Let you finish. Yeah, I thought you could say first. Yeah, it's not an indicator of strikeouts.
No. But we use it as an indicator of walks, and it's one of the ones we use less because ball percentage is actually better. But it does maybe in that narrative case suggest that Snell throws the balls, or you know, does have a couple of different modes where he'll pitch around guys, or you know, throw or establish strike one when he really needs to and doesn't want to walk the guy.
Can I
want to look at it more.
I'm gonna block. I didn't even block. I didn't block anybody on my Twitter feed, but I just got some.
You should try it. It's great.
Nah, you know what? I mean, no. I mean, if it gets to the point where it's that serious. No, I mean, people who call me, some of the names they call me, that's fine. Ron Chandler wrote back something to the fuck. You know, it don't ignore opinions of people that you don't respect. And I kind of, you know, I did that anyway. So, but anyway, enough of that.
My pick is a closer, Emmanuel Class A of Cleveland. He was the first closer taken by ADP in the third round this year, the 11th pitcher overall between Shane McClanahan and Max Scherzer. And he certainly delivered on the saves. Had 44, I think, this year, 5 more than Camilo Doval and David Bednar. But I think fantasy managers would have been far better off taking Doval at pick 102, or especially picking David Bednar at pick 131. Sure, you give up 5 saves, but what's the opportunity cost of the hitter you didn't get with that third round pick, or the starting pitcher you didn't get? I think we have to keep that kind of stuff in mind. And then Class A led all closers in blown saves. He had 12. He was among the worst. He was the third worst ERA among closers who had 30-plus saves. He was the fourth worst whip, 116 whip, and his 8.0 strikeouts per nine was by far the worst strikeout rate of any of the big closers that were drafted this year. He's never been a high strikeout guy, but 22% this year and a Wising walk rate, not too encouraging. And Terry Francona has all but announced that he's going to leave next year. He may already have announced that he's bowing out at the end of this year. I'm not sure. But Class A and his fantasy managers might not be able to count on Tito's managerial loyalty if Class A gets off to a slow start next year, low strikeouts, few more walks, couple more blown saves. If it's not the same manager, maybe the new manager wants to put his stamp on things. I don't think Emmanuel Class A is going to be worth the draft pick that it takes to get him next year, and for that reason, I'm out. So, guys, I guess that's it for another fantasy baseball season. We'll close here. I've got a quick question for you. Ray, who do you like for the World Series, and who's going to be in the final?
I somehow like the Phillies in the NL to defend, even ahead of the Braves and Dodgers with some of the pitching problems those two teams have. In the AL, give me Texas for now.
Todd, who do you like?
All right. This has nothing to do with the fact that half of my underdog teams had Seattle stacked, so they're already out. And my favorite team I drafted is the Brewers and Astros. So the fact that I'm going to say the Brewers and Astros has nothing to do with my underdog playoff teams that are still alive. No, I agree. You know, the pitching in the NL, I mean, look at, you know, the Braves with Morton, and, you know, the pitching is suspect. Battery can get cold. Milwaukee doesn't have a big two. They have a big three with Peralta. And hitters can do, I think, do enough to get in there. And I think Houston is just getting right at the right time. So I've talked about Toronto a little bit. I think they can get there. To me, the AL is wide open. Minnesota's pitching could match up with anybody.
Sure.
You know, but can they hit? And how can you disregard Tampa just because they have a team kind of built for the playoffs? So I know I'm all over the place here. I think I'm rooting for Milwaukee and Tampa. But my answer is going to be Milwaukee and Tampa. My underdog team, be damned.
I'm going to take Toronto based on their rotation. And for me, the reason is I think Gausman's the best pitcher in the series, and I expect him to win that opening game, and I expect Toronto to lose the second game, probably with Bassett on the hill. And then in the third game, I think everybody's expecting that they're going to send out Jose Berríos, the ex-twin, but I think they're going to send out Kikuchi because Minnesota does not fare well against left-handed pitching. And I think Kikuchi could be the ace in the hole that gets Toronto through that first round. And I think from then on, then they have four starters to go into seven-game series, which is something that hardly anybody else has except Milwaukee. As Todd has pointed out, they're very strong. So I'm taking Toronto and Milwaukee in the final, and I'm not bothered who wins. Of course, it'd be nice to have it north of the border again for a while, but not that important. Let's have a first pitch update before we go. Ray, you're the guy running the thing. Any new announcements?
Yeah, it's coming together. I actually, while during the pod today, while we were recording this, I got an email from the AFL. Today is apparently AFL opening day. So that's just another sign that First Pitch Arizona is around the corner. We've had a couple of flash sale promotions in the last couple weeks, and maybe keep an eye out for another one again later this week. But we're knocking on the door of record attendance, which would be really cool. And it's going to be an excellent weekend. We have some surprises in store. There's a Shell agenda for the weekend up on the website. We're continuing to fill in some blanks there. We're keeping a couple of things up our sleeves a little while longer, but I'm super excited about it. It's just about a month away, and can't get here soon enough.
Todd, you're going to be out?
I am going to be out, and I'm getting old, and I've been helping Ray out and Brent out and Ron out and Rick out back in the day. Been given, you know, and what my favorite, I've had the spotlight, and I told Ray this, and I told Brent this, and they're going to keep me busy, I'm sure. But my favorite part now is watching the maturation, the evolution of the younger people in this industry, and let them have the big panels. Let them have the spotlight. I've been there. It's helped me. I appreciate it. But I just love sitting back and listening to their talking during the games outside. I think this industry is in such great shape with the people coming up. And my favorite part is just to kind of be the fly on the wall and listen to some of this brain power go back and forth with these younger people that are not all young, but I think we have a great wave of analysts coming through, and they happen to congregate at First Pitch.
Very well said. 100% agree. Yeah, I absolutely agree as well. And it is really fantastic to see how many young people and how many young women are participating in First Pitch more than ever. And they have such interesting insights, and they take advantage of the skills that they've been learning in computers and databases and all the kinds of things that I only wish I had had access to back in the day. I was, working on my abacus and Blackboard. Stone tablets. Now they're using TI-40. iPods,
My TI-40. Yeah,
it's quite a great evolution in the game. And because all those young people are out there, plus older guys who have experienced that kind of thing, it makes for a really good mix of presenters and just people to talk to when you're hanging around. It's a great event. If you still haven't made up your mind, please give it a look. All right, boys, that'll do it. Ray, thanks very much for helping us out.
Thank you, PD. Always a pleasure. We'll do it again sometime in the offseason, I'm sure.
And Todd, thank you very much for participating in yet another roundtable. We'll see you in Phoenix.
This, gentlemen, I appreciate being the outsider to this festivities. I always enjoy it.
You're not an outsider. Come on.
Well, sort of an outsider.
Okay.
And that's Baseball HQ Radio for Tuesday, October the 3rd. Thanks very much for taking the time to download and listen to show number 34 of 2023, our end-of-season roundtable for the 2023 fantasy baseball season. I also want to thank our guest experts for this Tuesday roundtable edition, Todd Zola from Masters Ball, ESPN, SiriusXM, and RotoWire, and Ray Murphy, the co-general manager, projections meister, analyst, and writer at BaseballHQ.com, and of course, our regular news analyst here at Baseball HQ Radio. I'm Patrick Davitt, the host of Baseball HQ Radio. I sure hope to see you on the BaseballHQ.com subscriber forums. Also, remember you can stay in contact with Baseball HQ on Facebook and on our Twitter feed at Baseball HQ. You can also follow my personal Twitter feed at Patrick Davitt, where you'll always be the first to know when a new podcast is available. Please tell your friends about Baseball HQ Radio and take a second to go to Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Pocket Casts, Spotify, wherever you catch your pods, and leave Baseball HQ Radio a good review and a rating. That really does help us find new listeners, and new listeners help us keep the podcast going. If your pod getter of choice doesn't find Baseball HQ Radio, let us know about that or anything else on your mind by emailing bhqradio@gmail.com. Thanks again for listening. We'll be back again in the new year, unless something comes up earlier that obliges us to come back. And if you're attending First Pitch Arizona in a month or so, we'll see you there, and please come and say hello. If you're not going to Phoenix, well, keep watching the Twitter and your pod getter for the next edition of the podcast with Fantasy Baseball Intelligence for Winners. It is Baseball HQ Radio. Talk with you again, and for now, so long.
Baseball HQ Radio is a weekly free podcast available through iTunes and other podcast aggregators, or directly from baseballhq.com, where we have an archive of past shows as well. Just look for the HQ Radio microphone logo on the right side of the baseballhq.com homepage. Baseball HQ Radio is a production of the USA Today Sports Media Group. The opinions expressed on Baseball HQ Radio are those of the individual speaking and not necessarily those of the USA Today Sports Media Group. The program is produced and edited by Patrick Davitt.